Thank you, as always, to Greg and everyone under the aegis of the handsome Kipper the Cat. Now all making their way out of the studio, off to regions unknown. But I'm told they always go off with Evening Under Lamplight playing on the car radio, which is always tuned here to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. And all that remains for me to say is that I'm your host this evening, Under Lamplight, Robert Louis Abrahamson, inviting you to attend. What's in store for us this evening? Well, our passage from Walt Whitman speaks of the twirl of my tongue. We'll come later on to what that might mean, but I wanted to use this phrase as our theme. We'll have tongue twisters and then look at various tricksy ways of using the tongue, a language, to tell lies, truths, and deep truths. And to cap that discussion, we'll have a story for you, but only, boys and girls, if you behave well. Okay? So, Whitman talks about the twirl of my tongue, which suggests tongue twirlers and tongue twisters. And I have three songs of tongue twisters for you. First, here's Danny Kaye, such a versatile tongue, so elegant in his clowning, but he let them make some kind of popular idol of him, and lots of sentimental 1940s and 50s performances were produced, playing on his talents and his name. This song, called simply Tongue Twisters, is an example. Beneath the schlock of the swinging, jolly chorus and orchestration is Danny Kaye having great fun with one after another tongue twister that none of us could manage. Here, let's attend.
Everybody's heard of Peter Piper and the peck of pickled peppers that he picked. That's such a silly, simple children's game. It hasn't even got a name. But I'd like to bet that it'll trip you, like to bet you that you'll have to say you're licked. If Peter Piper you pronounce with ease, then twist your tongue around these. Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously. For Moses, he knows his toes ain't roses, and Moses supposes his toes to be.
That's tongue twister, and seems so easy till the word gets sprung. If you insist you want to try a list, then step up, mister, and twist your tongue.
Now, Kissel will whistle at busty Miss Russell, who rustle and bustle till Kissel will roar. So Russell asked Axel for Kissel's dismissal, and this'll teach Kissel to whistle no more.
That's tongue twister, and seems so easy till you twist your tongue.
Tito and Toto were tattooed in Toto, but Toto was only tattooed on his toe. So Toto told Tito where Toto was tattooed, but Tito said Toto's tattoo wouldn't show. Theta thought Thora was thumping her thimble, but Thomas thought Thora was thumping a drum. Said Theta, if Thora's not thumping her thimble, I think that she surely is thumping her thumb.
It's tongue twister, and seems so easy till the word gets sprung. If you insist you want to try a list, then step up, mister, and twist your tongue.
Now, Charlie is cherry when choosing his cheeses, and cheese is a challenge when Charlie arrives. But Charlie is charming and chooses a cheddar, then chills it and chips it and chops in some chives. Hedda is hoping to hop to Tahiti to hack a hibiscus to hang on her hat. Now, Hedda has hundreds of hats in her hat rack, so how can her hop to Tahiti help that? Snobby Miss Nora is sniffing a snuffer. The snuff has no sniff and it makes Nora sneeze. When Snide Alice Norton hears Nora is sneezing, she snappily snorts Nora sneezing a breeze. Sheila is selling her shop at the seashore, for shops at the seashore are so to lose. Now she's not so sure of what she should be selling. Should Sheila sell seashells or should she sell shoes?
Tongue twister, and seems so easy till the word gets sprung. If you insist you want to try a list, then step up, mister, and twist.
Twister for Twistle was twying to whistle, but Twister for twisted his tongue.
Right, Danny Kaye, tongue twisters. Not very witty, but it's always delightful to hear someone so adept at something so difficult. Then here's another tongue-twisting song, but with, I think, more wit and hence more delight. It's, yes, another Fraggle Rock song, here showing us a tongue-twisting game between Moki and Red. It begins with Moki, the sweet nature lover, showing Red the little beetle sitting on a stone, and from there it escalates into a wonderful back-and-forth game.
See the little thimble beetle sit. See the nimble thimble beetle sitting on a pitted spotted stone.
Mm, good.
Come on, fun.
See the beetle sitting on a
See the beetle sitting on a stone.
The little simple nimble thimble beetle's daughter's doing curtsies like a yodel as they sit in sticky spots up on a pitted spotted stone.
See the little simple nimble thimble beetle's daughter's doing curtsies like they otter as they sit on sticky spots upon a pitted spotted stone.
See the beetle sitting on a stone.
The little simple nimble thimble beetle's daughter's doing curtsies like they order as they sit and hit and spit and spat and split and flatten flowers on a pitted spot to
see. The little simple silly dimple pimple daughters as they flirt with dirty otters while they pit and flatten spatulas and smack a whiz and breath and satin flattered mats and hatters on a skitsy kidney stone.
See the beetle sitting on a
stone. See the beetle sitting on a
stone. See the beetle sitting on a
stone. See the little sitting on a stone.
If nothing else, that's a beautifully paced song, pulling up at just under 2 minutes. And as usual, the music behind the voices is subtle and witty and always just right. But our third song twister takes us to a higher plane. More sophisticated music from Arthur Sullivan and William Gilbert's extravaganza of rhyme and meter and surreal imagery. This is the Nightmare Song from Iolanthe. I used to recite it myself, but I won't do it now, not when we have John Reed to do it so well for us. It starts off slow, as all good tongue-twisting songs should, and then takes off.
Love, unrequited, robs me of my rest. Love, hopeless love, my ardent soul encumbers. Love, nightmare-like, lies heavy on me chest. And weaves itself into my midnight slumber.
When you're lying awake with a dismal headache, repose is taboo to my anxiety. I conceive you may use any language you choose to indulge in without impropriety. For your brain is on fire, the bedrooms conspire of usual slumber to plunder you. First your counterpane goes and uncovers your toes, and a sheet slips to mule you from under you. Then the blanketing tickles you, feel like mixed pickles, so terribly sharp is the pricking. And you're hot and you cross and you tumble and toss, there's nothing twixt you and the ticking. Then the bedrooms will creep to the ground in a heap and you pick them all up in a tangle. Next your pillow resigns and lightly declines to remain at its usual angle. Will you get some repose in the form of a doze with an eyeballs and head ever aching? But your slumbering teems in such horrible dreams that you'd very much better be waking. For you dream you are crossing the channel and tossing about in a steamer from Harwich, which is something between a large bathing machine and a very small second-class carriage. And you're giving a treat, penny ice and cold meat, to a party of friends and relations. They're a ravenous horde and they all came on board at some square in South Kensington stations. And bound on that journey you find your attorney who started that morning from Devon. He's a bit undersized and you don't feel surprised when he tells you he's only 11. Well, you're driving like mad with this singular lad. By the by, the ship's now a four-wheeler. And you're playing round games and he calls you bad names when you tell him the tides pay the dealer. But this you can't stand, so you throw up your hand and you find you're as cold as an icicle. In your shirt and your socks, the black silk with gold clocks, crossing Salisbury Plain on a bicycle. And he and the crew are on bicycles too, which have somehow or other invested in. And he's telling the tars all the particulars of a company he's interested in. It's a scheme of devices to get at low prices all puts of cough mixtures to cables, which tickled the sailors by treating retailers as though they were all vegetables. You get a good spade and to plant small traits and first take off his boots with a boot tree, and his legs will root and his fingers will shoot till they blossom and bud like a fruit tree. From the gringos a tree you get grapes and pippy, cauliflower, pineapple and cranberries, while a peach you could plant, your brandy will grant upon puffs and corners and benberries. The shares are a penny and ever so many are taken by Rothschild and Baring, and just as a few are allotted to you, you awake with a shudder despairing. You're a regular wreck with a crick in your neck and a one-deer snore for your head's on the floor, and you've needles and pins from your soles, you're singeing the fresh, you're creeping, and left leg's teeth, and you've cramping your toes, and a fly in your nose, and a fluff in your lung, and a feverish tongue, and a thirst for attention, a general sense that you haven't been sleeping in clover. But the darkness has passed, and it's daylight at last, and the night has been long, ditto, ditto, my song. And thank goodness.
yes, they're both of them over.
How was that? I hope you loved it. Perhaps my favorite bit is the new company this singular lad is telling all the tars the particulars of. It's a scheme of devices to get at low prices old goods from cloth mixtures to cables, which tickled the sailors by treating retailers as though they were all but tables. You get a good spadesman to plant a small tradesman, first take off his boots with a boot tree, and his legs will take root and his fingers will shoot and they'll blossom and bud like a fruit tree. From the greengrocer tree you get grapes and green peas, cauliflower, pineapple and cranberries, while the pastry cook plant cherry brandy will grant apple puffs and three corners and bamberries. The shares are a penny, and ever so many are taken by Rothschild and Baring, and just as a few are allotted to you, you awake with a shudder despairing. So, that's our tongue twisters segment. Genug schein, enough already, let's move on. The twirl of my tongue can, of course, mean more than just tongue twisters. It can also mean not speaking directly. And one way of not speaking directly is lying. So here's a little poem about lying, the story of Matilda, from Hilaire Belloc's Cautionary Tales, read by Peter Ustinov from a somewhat scratchy old vinyl record.
Matilda, who told lies and was burned to death. Matilda told such dreadful lies, it made one gasp and stretch one's eyes. Her aunt, who from her earliest youth had kept a strict regard for truth, attempted to believe Matilda. The effort very nearly killed her, and would have done so had not she discovered this infirmity. For once, towards the close of day, Matilda, growing tired of play, and finding she was left alone, went tiptoe to the telephone and summoned the immediate aid of London's noble fire brigade. Within an hour, the gallant band were pouring in on every hand, from Putney, Hackney Downs, and Bow, with courage high and hearts aglow. They galloped, roaring through the town. Matilda's house is burning down. Inspired by British cheers and loud, proceeding from the frenzied crowd, they ran their ladders through a score of windows on the ballroom floor and took peculiar pains to souse the pictures up and down the house until Matilda's aunt succeeded in showing them they were not needed, and even then she had to pay to get the men to go away. It happened that a few weeks later her aunt was off to the theatre to see that interesting play, The Second Mrs. Tanqueray. She had refused to take her niece to hear this entertaining piece, a deprivation just and wise to punish her for telling lies. That night, a fire did break out. You should have heard Matilda shout. You should have heard her scream and bawl and throw the window up and call to people passing in the street, the rapidly increasing heat encouraging her to obtain their confidence. But all in vain, for every time she shouted, "Fire!" they only answered, "Little liar!" And therefore, when her aunt returned, Matilda and the house were burned.
Well, that's one kind of lie, isn't it? But wait, before we speak further about lies, let's try to be clear what the opposite of lying is. Is it telling the truth? Well, yes, but what does that mean? Are we talking about truth of facts, accurately representing what is happening in the world? But it's easy to tell simple truths like the house is burning or the house is not burning. But how many truths are that simple? Here, I want to read you a wonderful passage from Robert Louis Stevenson, who has not joined us on Evening Under Lamplight for some time. Trying to map out any truth in our always changing world is like trying to trace the shadow of a great oak tree. The shadow of a great oak lies abroad upon the ground at noon, perfect, clear, and stable like the earth. But let a man set himself to mark out the boundary with cords and pegs, and were he never so nimble and never so exact, what with the multiplicity of the leaves and the progression of the shadow as it flees before the travelling sun, long ere he has made the circuit, the whole figure will have changed. Life may be compared not to a single tree, but to a great and complicated forest, circumstance is still more swiftly changing than a shadow, language much more inexact than the tools of a surveyor. From day to day the trees fall and are renewed. The very essences are fleeting as we look, and the whole world of leaves is swinging tempest-tossed among the winds of time. Look now for your shadows, so, oh, man of formulae, is this a place for you? Have you fitted the spirit to a single case? Alas, in the cycle of the ages, when shall such another be proposed for the judgment of man? Now, when the sun shines and the winds blow, the wood is filled with an innumerable multitude of shadows, tumultuously tossed and changing, and at every gust the whole carpet leaps and becomes new. Can you or your heart say more? Stevenson concludes, as we might expect from this kind of view, that true knowledge is eternally incommunicable. Even the twistiest of tongues cannot accurately express more than just a tiny part of what goes on in the world or inside ourselves. What can we do? We can, as Stevenson says, do battle for the truth. We don't give up even in the face of inevitable failure to communicate. We make the effort to see as clearly as we can, and then to twist our tongues so adeptly that we can make the best effort possible to express what we've seen. And we expect the other person to make an equal effort to take in our words and test them out to see what they could signify. And then if we've done a good job, we may have succeeded in sharing some particle of truth before the inevitable failure, as our momentary stay against confusion breaks up and we lose the moment. If that's what it's all about, then perhaps the wisest view is to welcome truth when it comes. But be aware that as life shifts, so does our perception of the truth, and we let it go lightly and gracefully. Leonard Cohen knew about this. Instead of trying to grasp the truth, we just sit in our unity, one with the other, below the need for words or twirls of the tongue. As the mist leaves no scar on the dark green hill, so my body leaves no scar on you and never will. Through windows in the dark, the children come, the children go, like arrows with no target, like shackles made of snow. True love leaves no traces if you and I are one. It's lost in our embraces, like stars against the sun.
Leaves no
faded away. That was Leonard Cohen, True Love Leaves No Traces, from the Phil Spector-produced album Death of a Ladies' Man, from way back in 1977. But who's counting? But there's another way to tell the truth. Not directly, but what Emily Dickinson calls telling it slant. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. Too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. This is a poem. Does it tell us the truth, or maybe just a truth? Yes, I think so, but it does this by twirling the tongue. Success, Dickinson says, lies in circuit. Notice how that line enacts what it's talking about, creating a kind of circuit of S and K sounds. Success in circuit lies. We go round and round, over and over, until we, maybe, get the point. Stevenson had said that we cannot tell the truth directly because the truth is too complex and too various for us to grasp. Dickinson puts it a little differently. The truth is too dazzling, she suggests. If we suddenly were told the whole truth about something, it would blind us. Or as George Eliot put it, and this is one of the great lines of English literature, folks, get ready. If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary human life, it would be like hearing the grass grow and the squirrel's heart beat, and we should die of that roar which lies on the other side of silence. As it is, the quickest of us walk about well wadded with stupidity. The quickest of us, the most alive and perceptive of us, walk about well wadded, insulated, with stupidity, in a kind of stupor. How's that? Even in our sharpest moments, we are insulated by our dumb ignorance, and this is for our own protection. The truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind.
Thank you.
That was Tantum Ergo by Bruckner. I thought this medieval hymn was appropriate at the moment, not only because of the way the Czech Philharmonic Choir takes us so delicately into the motet, so we are dazzled gradually, but because Thomas Aquinas's words fit what we were talking about, in a way. The last two lines say, and here, Evening Under Lamplight, once again, is the only community radio show that speaks to you in Latin. Priest et fides supplementum sensuum defectui. Let faith supplement our defective senses. This doesn't, of course, mean that we should be that kind of stupid and just take things on faith. It means that we should be aware of our limitations, our being well watered with stupidity, and then, rather than just sit there, act on faith, which is what we always do to some degree. We have faith that the person we're talking to will give us a fair or fair enough hearing, and so on. And I hope you're giving us a fair or fair enough hearing as we bring you Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, on Cambridge 105, inviting you to attend to our exploration of the twirl of my tongue. Maybe one way to put it, shifting our language to something perhaps more outrageous, mythology, is that when we twirl our tongue, we are entering the Hermes field. We are putting ourselves under the direction of Hermes, the trickster god, the god of language. All language involves trickery, for reasons we've been discussing. We can never really say anything straight, but tell all the truth slant. Along these lines, here's a passage I came across recently from Esther Duval's book Lost in Wonder. She's talking about the way that special twirl of the tongue called poetry works aslant to communicate its truths. Poetry deals in paradox and ambiguity. It works allusively and metaphorically, choosing words which startle and surprise, so that much is merely hinted at or left unsaid. A good poem does not limit or exhaust the realities of which it speaks, so I wait and allow it to reveal itself to me, for a poem comes to life only when I am fully attentive, and this may mean prepare to hear it a number of times. But then there comes a moment of discovery, a shock of recognition, which relates these words to my own experience in such a way that they open up a new realm of understanding or insight. Poetry can capture briefly but uniquely moments of recognition and epiphany, and new journeys begin with such moments. Journeys for which the poem becomes an agent of transformation.
She's got everything she needs. She's an artist, she don't look back. She's got everything she needs. She's an artist, she don't look back. She can take the dark out of the nighttime and paint the daytime black. You will start out standing proud to steal her anything she sees. You will start out standing proud to steal her anything she sees. But you will wind up peeking through her keyhole down upon your knees. She never stumbles, she's got no place to fall. She never stumbles, she got no place to fall. She's nobody's child, the law can't touch her at all. Egyptian ring, it sparkles before she speaks. She wears an Egyptian ring, it sparkles before she speaks. She's a hypnotist collector, you are a walking antique. Bow down to her on Sunday, salute her when her birthday comes. Bow down to her on Sunday, salute her when her birthday comes. For Halloween, buy her a trumpet, and for Christmas, get her a drum.
That's an amazing variety of music this evening, isn't it? Well, there's the artist with her Egyptian ring sparkling before she speaks, twirling her tongue in mysterious ways that, if we are attentive, can send us off on our own transformation. But we're not just talking about poetry or whatever art form that artist who don't look back practices. Even a simple story can come to us slant and work elusively and metaphorically, as Esther Duval says. Often such a story becomes transformed into what we call a myth, that is, a special story that rises above its own events to become a mirror showing us the universal patterns our individual actions partake in. And so here, let me tell you a story. It's a true story. Though by this point we know better than to take that word true in a straightforward way. This story, I'm assured, actually happened to a friend of mine, though he's told it to me in two different ways. So we ask, which version is the true version? Or actually, no, we don't ask that. We're not so literal-minded. I was concerned as a friend about what was happening to him, but then I can see the universal pattern here, and it's no longer about my friend, but about each of us. What shall we call this story? Maybe the slippery bridge. Or if we want some more Latin, De profundis clamavi, out of the depths I called out. Let's just call our hero John. That's not his real name, but remember, we're not going after literal truth here, so true names don't matter. Now, John was a member of a pretty significant Buddhist community in Philadelphia, and was given the job of looking after one of the great spiritual leaders of that community who was coming to the city on a visit. He was proud to be given this job and took it very seriously. Here comes Rinpoche, and John meets him at the airport. "We have 2 hours before you have to be at the center," he said. "Is there anything special you'd like to do before we go there?" "Yes," said Rinpoche. "Is there a little wooded place somewhere around here where we can walk and I can ground myself after my long flight?" "Of course," said John. "I know just the place." And he took him to one of Philadelphia's lovely parks, a very rural place where within a few minutes they were lost to the noise out there and surrounded by peaceful trees and undergrowth. After a bit, they came to a stream with no way to get across except a fallen tree which acted as a bridge. John bowed to Rinpoche to let him go first, and he nimbly walked over the tree trunk to the other side. John wasn't so lucky. Because he had taken on the role of the escort, he was wearing his best clothes, a fine suit and tie, and shiny black leather-soled shoes. You can imagine what happened then. The suit constricted his movements, the shoes were slippery, and he soon lost his balance and went toppling into the water. Full submersion, but the stream wasn't that deep, and he came up quickly, spluttering and gasping, feeling foolish, but more than that, ashamed that he had failed in dignity in front of this man whom it was so important to impress. But what he saw when he surfaced was the esteemed Rinpoche doubled over in laughter, making him feel even worse. This must have been apparent on his face, because once he climbed dripping out of the water onto the bank of the stream, Rinpoche stopped laughing and took John over to a log in the sunshine and sat calmly, speaking gently to him until his clothes dried off sufficiently to walk comfortably again. That's the story. We'll look further in a moment, but first, let's wade in the water with the CBS Jubilees.
Wade in the water.
Why don't you
wade in the water, children?
Wade in the water. You know my God's gonna trouble the water. Why don't you wade in the water? Why don't you wade in the water, children? Wade in the water. You know my God's gonna trouble the water.
The first step I took in the journey, let me tell you, water came about my knee. The second step, I kind of slanted, just slanted a little bit more. The water came, it came up to my waist. Oh, Lord, I decided to go out a little bit further. I noticed the water, I came over my head. Oh, he was making up my dying bed. Why don't you wait? Oh, Lord, just wait in the water. Why don't you wait? Hey, hey, Lord, in the water. Oh, just a little bit.
Hey,
in the water now.
You know my God's going to trouble the water.
Let me tell you, friend, you don't know why
going to trouble the water.
Let me tell you,
God's going to trouble the water.
Wade in the water, an old spiritual. There's some tongue twirling here, too. It's a song with many different meanings. On the one hand, it's a song about the Israelites crossing the Red Sea from slavery to freedom. Most versions speak about Moses leading the children of Israel. In which case, it's a song of hope and encouragement to the slaves in the American South. Many historians tell us it was also a coded song, counseling runaway slaves to keep in the water as much as possible so the dogs chasing them would lose the scent. But because crossing the Red Sea was often taken as an image of baptism, crossing over to new life, then the song takes on a religious meaning, or then there's crossing the Jordan River, which is not so much the escape from slavery as the entering into the Promised Land, and then it becomes, perhaps, a song about dying and going to heaven. But then there's the line that God's going to trouble the water, which reminds some people of the healing place in the Gospels, Bethesda, a pool into which an angel went down at certain season and troubled the water. Whosoever then first, after the troubling of the water, stepped in, was made whole of whatsoever disease he had. The gospel speaks of an angel doing this. The song speaks of God troubling the water. But we're not invited to quibble over these things. What we see, though, is the way this image of wading in the water becomes a tongue twirler, conveying many different truths at the same time. As Esther Duval said, a good poem does not limit or exhaust the realities of which it speaks. But back to our story. Let's see how we can twirl it so it says more than it at first tells us. There's John, in his clothes, fit for the occasion, as long as all he has to do is chauffeur Rinpoche around town and over to the centre where he was due to speak that evening. But the occasion shifted, and he found himself in a woods, and then a further shift as he has to negotiate a slippery fallen tree over the stream, and now the clothes are entirely unfit. So they get a soaking. Does this tell us that it was wrong or silly or something to have come in good street clothes? No. They were right for the start of the occasion. But we have to expect what is right for the start of a journey may well not be right further down along the journey. In fact, it could even lead us straight to a slip-up. There's our first point about the shifting nature of each moment stirred by Hermes' mischievous hand. And is this a mirror for you? Do you see in it some occasion in which you started out well prepared, but some shift in events caused you to find yourself entirely in the wrong position, and you fell off your comfortable place into failure and humiliation? Next, since water often symbolizes our unconscious, we can take that incident of falling into the water as an image of our ego losing control and our falling into our unconscious self. Losing control can look ridiculous, to others anyway. And we often, or usually, take this as a sign of humiliating failure. But we have just lost our balance, that's all. What can we do but get up and continue our journey across the stream, only now in a slightly different mood and appearance? It would be a different thing altogether if the stream weren't so shallow and John had been really injured or drowned. But that's another story. Coming out of the stream, of course, is a kind of baptism image, a cleansing image. What did we wash off when we fell? Some aspect of ego? In what way are we coming out a new or newly reborn self? What might this be mirroring for you? And then what happens? The wise, loving presence waiting there, taking us lightly, amused while we take ourselves so seriously. In the next minute, extends himself to our heart. And the two of us sit in the sunshine, his kindness and the sun working together so that the water rises up off us and we regain our poise, our fitness for proceeding on the journey. And so we have a story of rebirth, which we go through over and over. The tag we might take away is something like, when did you last slip off the tree bridge into the stream you were trying so carefully to cross over? Who laughed and who gently sat with you as you dried off? What new changes were occurring in you through this episode? Thus, we can see our lives as myth-generating and myth-connected. The bridge may fail us, but there's that other presence who takes the place of the bridge over troubled water, laying himself down for us, comforting us, and taking our part.
Troubled water, I will. silver girl. Sail on by, your time has come to shine. All your dreams are on their way. See how they shine.
Simon and Garfunkel, of course, A Bridge Over Troubled Water. Oh no! After all that tongue twirling, we've left ourselves very little time for Walt Whitman, and this week's reading is especially twirly twisty, not easy to grasp. Whitman is saying that his joy at the wonders of nature is so great he would burst if he could not express something. With the twirl of my tongue, I encompass worlds and volumes of worlds. And yet words, even twirling words, can never fully express what he has experienced. His deepest self, the best I am, is always going to be hidden. Encompass worlds, but never try to encompass me, he says. So Whitman abandons words and asks us just to look into his face, just to be with him. Writing and talk do not prove me. I carry the plenum of proof and everything else in my face. With the hush of my lips, I confound the topmost skeptic. You're skeptical about my words? Okay, just look into my face. That's the gist of it. I'll read our section now. Take what you can from it. Come back to it and see what new things catch you next time, and go deeper as you may. Dazzling and tremendous, how quick the sunrise would kill me if I could not now and always send sunrise out of me. We also ascend dazzling and tremendous as the sun. We found our own, my soul, in the calm and cool of the daybreak. My voice goes after what my eyes cannot reach. With the twirl of my tongue, I encompass worlds and volumes of worlds. Speech is the twin of my vision. It is unequal to measure itself. It provokes me forever. It says sarcastically, Walt, you understand enough. Why don't you let it out then? Come now, I will not be tantalized. You conceive too much of articulation. Do you not know how the buds beneath are folded, waiting in gloom, protected by frost, the dirt receding before my prophetical screams, I underlying causes to balance them at last? My knowledge, my live parts, it keeping tally with the meaning of things, happiness, which whoever hears me, let him or her set out in search of this day. My final merit, I refuse you. I refuse putting from me the best I am. Encompass worlds, but never try to encompass me. I crowd your noisiest talk by looking toward you. Writing and talk do not prove me. I carry the plenum of proof and everything else in my face. With the hush of my lips, I confound the topmost skeptic. And now, good night from me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, thanking you for sharing this evening under lamplight here on Cambridge 105. See you next time, and keep that tongue twisting. Keep that tongue twirling. But also, hush your lips and confound all those skeptics. Now we hear from the album Miles from India. It's a song called, or a track called Jean-Pierre. Good night.